Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Radulich, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise, court is now in session. The Honorable Christopher Lambert is presiding. I'm your host, Mr. Mark Radulich, your mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified. And this is On Trial, and on tonight's docket is the 1995 Mortal Kombat! Directed by Paul Anderson, master of all things movie video games. And... yeah. And showing, you know, he directed those legendary Oscar-winning Resident Evil movies. Joining me to save us all from my silliness is your defense attorney for this evening's proceedings, Mr. Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
All of that notwithstanding, I am a happy little Shang Tsung main.
So we've been talking all week about Mortal Kombat, the IP, mm-hmm. the video game, the cartoon, you know, the this, the that, and the other thing. I've mm-hmm. had my say. I've talked a little bit about my familiarity with the game and this, and I did an entire podcast on the soundtracks gushing about them. How about you? Tell us about your history with the with this particular property.
Yeah, well, I mean, and let this kind of serve sort of as my ad hoc notes section. I played the first three games quite a damn little bit. The first one came out in 1992, and it was an absolute outlier from anything else in the fighting game market, and that was very much on purpose. That was the way Midway's Ed Boon and John Tobias kind of drew it up, was they wanted something that was going to be edgier, bloodier, much more intense than the really colorful, bombastic fare out there, like in particular Street Fighter. That was for many moons the biggest competitor to Mortal Kombat, was, you know, the Street Fighter franchise. And the way they originally envisioned it was that they wanted to make a fighting game version of Universal Soldier, featuring a digitized motion-captured model of Jean-Claude Van Damme himself. And they definitely wanted it to be not your kid brother's fighting game. And let me tell you something, when the first one came out, myself and every other kid I knew played the ever-loving hell on it. And I had the fortune to play the Sega Genesis version. So we had the blood code, much to the abject chagrin of my parents, and I played with it on every single damn time, thank you very much. Super Nintendo version, of course, did not. Nintendo was very particular about their censorship. But the funny thing about the first game was you had this one very prosaic screen before the main title that directly alluded to various kinds of codes, including a code of blood. Like, just abjectly saying, enter it here. We know you know it. We're just gonna sit here for a second while you sort it out. So, the first game comes out, and it sets the video game world on fire. Its controversial brutality is, of course, the reason why we've had to deal with the fuckery of the ESRB ever since then. It absolutely horrified parents. It became the utmost public enemy of moral majority politicians who swore this was going to be the ruin and corruption of the youth of America.
I remember that very distinctly. I have watched the occasional 700 Club when they were going after the contemporary heavy metal bands of the new wave of heavy metal in the mid to late 90s. So like
the Satanic Panic.
Yeah, well, this was Satanic Panic 2. This was Pantera, Sepultura, Soundgarden, and so I've watched those attacks via that medium, and I do remember them also including video games in it, and yeah, Public Enemy number one was Mortal Kombat.
Oh, sure, sure, sure. Well, then the second game comes out, and it expands dramatically on not only the roster, but in a real revolution for fighting games, it really amps up the lore and deepens the backstory of the first game. And then in 1995, the third game came out. Actually, the third game came out April 15th, 1995. The movie we're reviewing today came out in August. So Mortal Kombat was pretty thoroughly entrenched by this point. And as with every major media pillar of the zeitgeist at the time, of course, Hollywood was going to cling on and dry hump it until it developed an embarrassing rash. Only in this case, the rash could have been worse. Like a lot worse. I mean, when you consider that this came out well after the debacle that was Super Mario Brothers and Street Fighter the movie, it is a goddamn miracle this thing came out as well as it did in terms of doing the franchise justice. And that especially is true when you look at who was responsible for it. It is the factor that absolutely boggles my mind to this very day. And that's the fact that what I have often cited on this show and many others as being the measuring stick for making a video game movie that is truly a love letter to the franchise, this one was helmed by the utter fuck knuckle who would bend the Resident Evil and Monster Hunter franchises over the table until Capcom was practically screaming, "Excuse me, could we take a break and reapply the lube? Getting a little dry back here." to which he said, "No, we're done when Mila says you're done."
Just as an aside, I will always have a positive, like, giddy memory of Monster Hunter. I have no connection to the game,
That's why you have positive memories of it.
Well, also, if you haven't seen the movie yet, I'm guessing you have. That's where some of that's coming from. There's a jump scare where it was the thing where something jumps out of the water, and attacks them. And I took my kids to go see Monster Hunter, and I talked about this on the podcast at the time. But Jonas screaming and nearly jumping so high out of his chair like a cartoon cat and hanging from the theater ceiling when whatever it was jumped out of the water was the funniest thing I'd seen in 2020.
Let him play Monster Hunter World and Rise. I guarantee you he will become decidedly less impressed with that movie going forward.
Someday when Ezzy gets older, oh gosh, what's the name of them? It's one of these horror first-person shoot-em-ups, one of the early ones.
First-person? Doom?
No, it wasn't Doom. It might have been around the PlayStation era.
You sure it was first-person?
You're walking around like a haunted house. There's like zombies and like monster dogs and stuff.
Red, that would be Resident Evil.
Is that Resident Evil?
Oh, dear God.
It's been so long, I don't remember. But I do remember that because I remember there was a jump scare in that one, and me and my friends were like, oh, God.
Oh, yes. Trust me. to borrow a tag the tagline from Mortal Kombat, to nothing can prepare you for the rants that await you when we get to Resident Evil, the final chapter.
Coming to an on trial later this year.
Oh, it's coming. Those of you who wanted one last dance with Shouty Sean, be careful what you wish for. I have thoughts and notes. So many notes.
Your last thoughts here, in your preamble on Mortal Kombat, and then we'll get into the plot.
All right. My final thoughts on it are, I played the first three games, absolutely adored them. They were far and away my favorites above Street Fighter. I didn't really play any of the series after that until 2010, when I picked up, or no, 2011, yeah, it was 2011, when I picked up the reboot that relaunched the franchise, Mortal Kombat 9, which is it has easily the most impressive, astonishing, deep story. And deep not as in emotional, it's not Shakespeare here, but deep as in well thought out. Story that manages to meld together the story of the first three games in the series into an incredibly well orchestrated about 3-ish hours or so of gameplay. And amazingly, the next two games after managed to take the story even further, expand the cast, and actually topped the first one. If you're going to come into the series, I would actually tell you, controversial opinion as this may be, just ignore everything up until Mortal Kombat 9, play 9, 10, and 11.
All right, so here we go. So we have Mortal Kombat, directed by the aforementioned Paul Anderson, produced by Lawrence Kasdan. It stars Lyndon Ashby, Cary Hayuki Tagawa, Robin Shao, Bridget Wilson, Talisa Soto, and the immortal, because there can be only one, Christopher Lambert. This was put out by New Line Cinema, famous for the Nightmare on Elm Street series and a lot of like the Wes Craven stuff. It had a budget of $18 million and it was a wild success by comparison. It made $122 million, so of course there was a sequel. There was a soundtrack that like went platinum. I mean, I guess I remembered this being worse than it really was, but apparently in its time, it might not have been the most wildly critically acclaimed thing that's ever been produced, but you know, people seem to have loved it. And everything, you know, associated with it made money at the time. So here we go. Mortal Kombat is a martial arts tournament that is held every once a generation between the representatives of the realms of Earth and Outworld, conceived by the Elder Gods amid looming invasion of the Earth by Outworld, those nasty ne'er-do-wells. If the realm of Outworld achieves 10 consecutive victories, its emperor will be able to invade and conquer the Earth realm. They have already won 9 times. Dun, dun, dun. Shaolin monk Liu Kang and his comrades, movie star Johnny Cage, and military officer Sonya Blade, are chosen by Raiden, the god of thunder and defender of Earth realms, and sarcastic Christopher Lambert, to overcome their powerful adversaries in order to prevent Outworld from winning their 10th straight Mortal Kombat tournament. Each of these three has his or her own reason for competing. Liu seeks revenge against the tournament host Shang Tsung for killing his brother Chan. Sonya seeks revenge on an Australian crime lord, Kano, for murdering a fellow officer. And Cage seeks to prove that his martial arts skills are real, because he's a Hollywood actor and stuff. At Shang Tsung's island, Liu is attracted to Princess Katana, because she's a hottie, the emperor's adopted daughter. Aware that Katana is a dangerous adversary because she is the rightful heir to the throne of Outworld and that she will attempt to ally herself with Earth's warriors, Sung orders the creature Reptile to spy on her. Liu defeats his first opponent, and Sonya gets her revenge on Kano by snapping his neck like you do. Cage encounters and barely beats Scorpion. Lou engages in a brief duel with Katana, who secretly offers him cryptic advice for his next battle. Lou's next opponent is Sub-Zero, whose defense seems untouched because of his freezing abilities until Lou recalls Katana's advice and uses a bucket of water to defeat Sub-Zero like he's the Wicked Witch of the West. Prince Goru enters the tournament and mercilessly crushes every opponent he faces. One of Cage's peers, Art Lean, is defeated by Goro as well and has his soul taken by Shang Tsung. Sonya worries that they might not win against Goro, but Raiden disagrees. He reveals their own fears and egos are preventing them from winning the tournament. Despite Sonya's warning, Cage comes to Tsung to request a fight with Goro. The sorcerer accepts on the condition that he be allowed to challenge any opponent of his choosing anytime, anywhere he chooses. Raiden tries to intervene, but the conditions are agreed upon before he can do so. Shang Tsung leaves. Raiden confronts Cage for what he has done in challenging Goro, but is impressed when Cage shows his awareness of the gravity of the tournament. And gravity is about to come into major play here. Thank you. Cage faces Goro and uses Guile, and not the character from Street Fighter, and the element of... and the element
hey,
of...
Steve goes with everything.
to defeat the defending champion. Now desperate, Tsung takes Sonya hostage, like you do, and takes her to Outworld, intending to fight her as his opponent. Knowing that his powers are ineffective there and Sonya cannot defeat Tsung by herself, Raiden sends Lou and Cage into Outworld in order to rescue Sonya and challenge Tsung. In Outworld, Lou is attacked by Reptile, under orders from Shang Tsung to prevent him and Cage from rescuing Sonya, but eventually gains the upper hand and defeats him. Afterwards, Katana meets up with Cage and Lou. She reveals to the pair the origins of both herself and Outworld. Katana allies with them and helps them to infiltrate Sung's castle while advising Liu Kang about three challenges in his castle to face his enemy, himself, and his worst fear. Inside the castle tower, Shang Tsung challenges Sonya to fight him under the false claim that her refusal will result in Earthrealm forfeiting the tournament. All seems lost for Earthrealm until Katana, Liu, and Cage appear. As Sonya is secretly freed, having also just recently gotten a really wicked makeover, Katana berates Tsung for his treachery to the Emperor, claiming that his arrogance and greed will cost him the tournament if he doesn't honor the deal. Tsung challenges Cage, but is counter-challenged by Liu. During the lengthy battle, Liu faces not only Tsung, but the souls that Tsung had forcibly taken in past tournaments. In a last-ditch attempt to take advantage, Tsung morphs into Chan, seeing through the charade. Liu renews his determination and ultimately fires an energy bolt at the sorcerer, knocking him down and impaling him on a bed of spikes. Sung's death releases all the captive souls, including Chan's, before ascending to the afterlife. In the afterlife, Chan tells Liu that he will remain with him in spirit until they are once again reunited. The Earth Warriors return to Earthrealm, where a victory celebration is taking place at Liu's Shaolin Temple. But the jubilation abruptly stops when the giant figure of the Outworld Emperor suddenly appears like Skeletor in the He-Man movie in the sky and declares he has come for everyone's souls. Raiden replies, "I don't think so." And the warriors take up fighting stances and the Utah Saints play and all is good in the world. All right. So this does not have to be a lengthy prosecutorial bit that I'm going to do here. I know for the length and breadth we've been doing the show, one of us takes a hardline attack of whatever it is we're talking about, and the other one a hardline defense. Mm-hmm. And Sean and I were talking before the show. One, I don't think the movie lends itself to that. It's one of those. Yeah, it's one of those where it's not perfect. And I'll be tasked with talking about what's not perfect about this movie, you know, what some of the problems with it. But I'm going to just say up front, I love this. I thought it was great. My son had a great time watching it. My daughter enjoyed it. Like, this is one of those things where I don't really want to beat this movie up. We kind of had the same issue with No Holds Barred. It was like, this is just fun and nostalgic and, you know, and it tickles my nipples. You know, I enjoy this sort of thing. So why do I want to spend 10 to 20 minutes trying to think of all the bad things about it? So here's sort of an honest kind of damn you, Hollywood. Here's what's wrong with it. The acting is not great. It's better than 2025. But let's try that one more time. Take two. It's better than 2021. Yeah, that's the year we're in. You know, the gal who plays Sonya Blade, Bridget Wilson.
Bridget Wilson, yeah.
Yeah, Bridget Wilson's actually plays the character better than her contemporary. You know, Johnny Cage, the guy who plays him, Lyndon Ashby, he's not perfect. He probably gives the weakest performance out of all of them, but he has a certain dopey charm about him. You know, the problem is his acting's not so bad. It may drag the movie down. His acting is about as bad as the movie allows it to be. This is not, you know, high art here. This is a movie based on a video game where people fight in a, you know, in a goofy tournament. And he hits the pitches of the movie that the movie's generally hitting. So, like, his bad acting doesn't really stand out all that much. And it's not, like, so bad we're at like, asylum levels. So he's perfectly adequate in his goofy role. And he's good-looking, and he has a lot of charm and sex appeal. And, you know, he's... And I know that because he turned my daughter off. My daughter hated him. So I was like, clearly his sex appeal is working. Liu Kang is 100 times better than his contemporary in 2021. He actually has a fully formed character. You get a sense of his, you get a sense of his motivation. You get some elements of his character. I mean, nobody's totally like fleshed out here, but as much as you can flesh out a character in this sort of environment, this film environment, he does a good job, and he's as the star of the movie. He, you know, the one that we're following, the point of view character, he's fun to follow. And you're like, that doesn't sound like a criticism. Well, again, none of these people are going to be winning any Oscars anytime soon, but it was good enough for this movie. The look of the movie is better than the modern one, with two exceptions, and you can hear us talk about. Yeah, you can hear us talk about those two exceptions on Damn You Hollywood. I was very clear that there were two set pieces that I thought looked gorgeous and made the movie for me. And the rest of it's in, you know, the rest of it's in a sandy cave. This one has a different problem where, you know, where they're fighting on this island, some of it looks pretty good, and some of it, it feel, you know, it's clearly on a set. It looks like it's on a set. It looks like kind of painted, foamy, you know, set pieces, and I think they were going for what the game looks like. That just might be my prejudice against the game. The game isn't something I paid attention to as a kid, but I think back on it, I'm like, huh, the environments might have always been dark and dingy and, you know, this sort of off-putting violet red color. And that's a lot of where this movie takes place, unfortunately. So it isn't very pretty to look at. I think if you're like a staunch follower of the game and it resembles enough of the game for you, you A, don't care. B, think the movie did a good job of doing the game justice. As a film person and not judging it against the game, I didn't think the movie was very pretty to look at, and I got kind of bored with some of the set pieces. Still superior to 2021, but still not great. It's my big theme of the criticism here. It's fine, just not great. I'm not a good judge of fight choreography. I think the fights in 2021 are better overall, especially the bookended fights in the beginning and at the very end, than 1995 seems a little too stagey, a lot of the fight scenes, and I do remember this being a major criticism of the 1995 film, because they went with PG-13, wanting to maximize their audience. They want to get the kids in there.
Oh, yeah.
They did not lean into the fatalities of the game, which are its major selling point. And so I think for a lot of people, that's where this movie falls flat on its face. It's not nearly, you know, gory enough. And then again, going back to the actual fight choreography, it's too clean, it's too pretty. It's very dancey martial arts, which is great because with the music that's playing, you know, it all goes really, really well with the Utah Saints. But if you're looking for sort of authentic John Wick-y, you know, Cobra Kai, authentic martial arts looking in a, you know, in a movie scenario, this one fails miserably. It's way too ballet looking. This isn't a fair criticism, but since we're talking about criticisms, I'm sure in 1995 the special effects and the puppeteering were as state-of-the-art as you were going to get for the budget and for the time. They don't hold up. I just watched this the other day. Maybe if you're a child, you don't notice it, but as an adult and an adult that's watched modern CGI, this shit just doesn't hold up at all. It is clearly, very clearly puppeteering. It is very clearly dated special effects. Charming for its time, doesn't hold up over time. You know, 20 years later, and I'm like, no. this is, we're not quite Masters of the Universe level, but it ain't much better. finally, and this is also probably not fair, given what we're talking about, but you get a really good introduction, and then it's fight with not a lot of any kind of recognizable plot, which is weird because I complained about the opposite problem in 2021. They haven't quite figured out where exactly to put a plot one can follow to keep you interested in what these characters are doing and staying true to the tournament style fight. And that's the thing, is I'm almost wondering if an approach to this is let them do a thing, let them go a place, let them find a stuff, and the conclusion is the tournament. Like a modern sports movie kind of a thing. You know, let's build up to the tournament rather than stretch the tournament over the wide and breadth of this film. You kind of have the same problem that you have with 2021 with the 95 Mortal Kombat, which is when they're not fighting, nothing interesting is happening all that much. Christopher Lambert is always fun. Christopher Lambert is probably the high point of this movie for me. He is hilarious in this, and he looks like he is having a grand old time. This is what I wanted from Nick Cage in Jiu-Jitsu. I wanted Christopher Lambert's Raiden. which I did not get, unfortunately, into Alexis Haina's chagrin. So he's fine. He's carrying the scenes that he's in, but nobody else, you know, is really able to do that. So all that's left is the fighting. And if you like the fighting, you're interested. If you're like me and you're like, a little too ballet-ish, it's not all that interesting. And you're just like, this is sort of like an endless, like this kind of just goes on forever. And then it finally gets to the conclusion, and this might sound like a nitpick, but gosh, poor Sonya Blade. She's like this bad, when you meet her, she's this fucking badass. You know, she's like Mother's Day Out is playing and she's just shooting fuckers at a club, man. She's like, boom, headshot, you know, Jax is holding up their head like, I'm gonna kill all these motherfuckers dancing in here tonight. You know, where's Kano? I'll kill a bitch. And you're like, all right, Sonya Blade, man. And then the whole movie, she's like, listen, Mr. Sexy Johnny Cage, you and your penis can go for a walk. I don't need none of you. I'm a badass soldier woman. And my daughter is like, hell yeah, that's what I want to see. And this is the same beat throughout the movie. I don't need no, I'm a big strong woman who don't need no man. I'm a big strong woman who don't need no man. I'm a big strong woman who don't need no man. Then they turned her into Lita Ford for some odd reason. She got a sexy makeover. She jumped on the... Lita Ford is giving her too much credit. She turned into Tawny Katan. She jumped on the hood of the car. She said, she's my cherry pie. And then chained her in the basement. Poor gal. And then she has to be saved by big, strong man Johnny Cage. And as we all know from watching Man of Steel and... You know, with Superman and Lois, that if you save a woman once, she'll madly fall in love with you forever. That's how it works. I'm rolling my eyes so hard, my forehead hurts. And so, like I said, like, they made this, they wrote up this really fun character who's a big strong woman who don't need no man, and then like instantly falls in love with Johnny Cage for no good reason. Well, looking like, you know, like an 80s fucking rock video whore. Oh, fuck. And it was like, was that a studio note? Did they feel like, well, we have no romance in this movie, so what if Johnny Cage and Sonya Blade get together at the end? Well, you gave them no reason to do that. You gave them no reason. Gosh, what is this run of movies we're doing where the male and female lead are only together because, you know, the script says they have to, but there's nothing supporting it? We did this with Kong, too. Just, like, that whole end thing was solely resting on the shoulders of Liu Kang, and that was great. He had great motivation. That motivation was played out and set off at the very end. You know, Shang Tsung turns into his brother and all that. That's all great stuff. That's all fun. That all works. That's a great conclusion for Liu Kang, whose movie this really needed to be resting on. Johnny Cage is just fucking like hanging out in his monk robe. He saves Tawny Katan. And then they hold hands and walk into the fucking sunset. That's their conclusion after all of that. You don't really get any kind of satisfying ending to his quest to be, you know, the new martial art, the new Chuck Norris. You don't get any... I mean, they resolved her big conflict when she killed Kano, speaking of Superman, by snapping his neck. And then she's just damsel in distress, which I think sinks the character. So, yeah, so the conclusion is one part not good, and that's all the Johnny Cage, Sonya Blade stuff, and one part great, because it's all the stuff that's focusing on Liu Kang. So it's a very uneven conclusion. Before I hand it over to Sean, I won't speak for you this time, Sean, I promise. I'll let you have your own mind. You're welcome. I want to take a moment to talk to you about Grammarly. Grammarly, for you listeners of On Trial on the Rattle Engine Broadcasting Network and W2M, Grammarly is offering a free download of the Grammarly software. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes, while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M Network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M Network to download Grammarly for free. Your witness, sir.
You know, I kind of feel a little bit bad for this movie. And it feels strange to say that I feel like this comes along about 15 years too early, considering that we just got a rebooted Mortal Kombat movie. But what I kept thinking about as you were kind of rattling off your opinions of sort of the Katana Liu Kang pairing and, of course, Sonya and Johnny, is just kind of lamenting, going, God damn, man, you were experiencing the wrong story. this was only two games into the franchise. And in terms of the games, and I know, we're just here to talk about movies, they really developed those two couples into two of the big pivot points in the Earthrealm Outworld conflict, such as it were. And again, we're talking about the reboots, the ones that started from the story of the first game and then just pressed it forward into its own whole ass thing. But one thing that I will positively say right off the bat about this movie, and again, I'm going to keep harping on this because it baffles me to this day. Paul Anderson gets so much right when it comes to the games, and what he changes doesn't really detract from any of that. Definitely not to the point where it takes you out of the experience, if you're a fan, to where it no longer feels like a Mortal Kombat movie. Because Hollywood, especially when it comes to video game movies, has this weird have our cake and eat it too philosophy. It's like, it's popular enough that we want to make a movie to capitalize on it. We want to strike while the iron is hot, which definitely means we absolutely want to draw in fans of the source material. But only in so much as, you know, we'll lend them some pandering fan service and in-jokes, and otherwise we're just going to kind of do our own thing with their cutesy little new media story, because fuck them, we don't have to pander to them. We don't have to do it their way. We'll do our own thing with it. Well, your own thing usually ends up being terrible, because the source material was good in the first place. And that's the thing about when you're adapting something from story-driven media. The story is right fucking there. Nobody is really asking you necessarily to improve on what the original author, artist, producer, writer, director, what have you, did. We just want you to translate it to a different medium. That's all we're really asking. We're not telling you, take this and fix what you think is wrong with it. And Anderson, in this case, he manages to tell the story of the first game with the addition of one character from Mortal Kombat 2 who was not in the first one, and that's Katana. That's it. Everything else, the cast, their depictions, most of their backstories, it's by the numbers. Almost right down the line. There's no bit where Liu Kang is trying to avenge his little brother's death. You know, that part was a device of Anderson. That shit where Reptile is that weird kaleidoscopic liquid creature thing. Yeah, also a concoction of the movie. Katana's attire and presentation is entirely different from the game. But again, that stuff is all forgivable. You know, it's not presented in such a way that it takes anything away. Oh, and the one other thing, in the first game, you know, Shang Tsung is an ancient sorcerer. He's centuries old, and he looks every single second of it. He doesn't kind of regain his youth until the second game through a bargain with Shao Kahn. But let that be a testament to the actors that for the cheesy dialogue and, yeah, you know, performances that nobody in their right mind is going to mistake for Sir Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. But you're talking about performances that were so true to the characters they were supposed to be that you know, just last year, in the year of the Western Plaguelands, 2020, 25 fucking years after this movie, Mortal Kombat 11 received a skin pack so that you could redress Raiden, Sonya Blade, and Johnny Cage as Christopher Lambert, Bridget Wilson, and Lyndon Ashby, including lending their voices to it. Harry Tokugawa, that fucking global treasure, became so iconic, so beloved for his portrayal of Shang Tsung that there was no need for an extra skin pack. When they introduced Shang Tsung as DLC, he was the voice and the character model. It is glorious. And the fan service, it's not lampshaded. Well, okay, a few times. Obviously, it's a Mortal Kombat movie. You're going to get flawless victory. Fatality.
No one said friendship. I immediately ducked at a point.
By the way, you want to talk a voice that will get you insta-pregnant. Just saying. Just saying. Shang Tsung gonna knock you up. Bleed that. But, you know, so many of the signature moves and moments are there. Write down, do you know Scorpion? Just like a real life, really shitty Scorpion main. Does nothing but throw spears for like 10, 15 minutes. Like all he does. Everybody looks the way they're supposed to look. They sound the way you expect them to sound. I highly encourage you to go hit up Dead Meat on YouTube and watch their Kill Count episode, wherein James A. Janisse takes a moment to appreciate some of the surprisingly ambitious artistry that went into creating Goro. And I gotta say, yeah, while he's not exactly holding up to the cave troll in the Fellowship of the Ring, when you look at him now and you consider the time and you consider kind of how well he plays against the human actors, pretty damn impressive. Pretty damn impressive. You know, that's, yeah, there's some CGI there, but for the most part, that's a human being wearing an elaborate animatronic to make all that happen. And it comes across pretty well. By the way, little fun fact, in Mortal Kombat 11, if you venture into the crypt, into Goro's lair, you'll notice there is a nice little Easter egg of Kano's skeleton sitting at the table. It's pretty cool. But is it a simple story? Yes. But at the time, the story of the game was really fairly simple. And yeah, it's centered on the tournament. At the time, that was the story. That's true. Got to win 10 tournaments in order to absorb Earthrealm. They had won 9 straight. And it's up to one select, plucky cabal of Earthrealm protectors to save the entire realm from the clutches of Shao Kahn and Shang Tsung. You know, that's... granted, the structure of the tournament is never really all that clear. wasn't really in the game either. You're playing it basically in a ladder format. It's not like there's a bracket or anything. But for playing with what little they had to work with, Anderson makes a better movie than having fucking, at the time, what did he have? Like 5, 6 Resident Evil games? He could have drawn inspiration from more than that by the time the franchise ended? And it was still an utter clusterfuck?
Wow, this is only his second movie.
I know, right?
Holy crap. Like, he hadn't even gotten to Resident Evil yet, like, and won't for a few more years. His first movie was Shopping. That was his directorial debut, and then Mortal Kombat. And then he followed up with the Event Horizon. Yikes.
Yeah. I know. And Monster Hunter has fucking lore and world building that arguably goes back even further than either of these movies. And Jesus, let us never speak of the shortcut again. And yet here, he's taking a 2-game-old property. And again, the third game, which would go on to make up the framework of Mortal Kombat Annihilation, it had been out for less than a year by that point. I mean, by that point, this was, I got to imagine, probably in post-production. So that was probably an afterthought. But the interplay between the characters, I think is just wonderful. Robin Shu makes a fantastic Liu Kang. Lyndon Ashby takes a character that was supposed to be, again, a bit of a dig at Jean-Claude Van Damme, and really kind of makes him his own. You know, Bridget Wilson, yeah, I'll take her Sonya Blade over Ronda Rousey in MK11 any day of the week. Kano was spot the fuck on. It's kind of a shame that Scorpion and Sub-Zero got such short shrift, because really, when it comes to lore, even going back to those first two games, they've had some of the best of the franchise. But at the very least, no lie, it was cool as fuck to see them looking and sounding and acting exactly like we would expecting real life flesh and blood ninja bros from rival clans to look. It's just, especially for the time, it's everything you could have asked a game like this. You could have asked a movie based on a game like this to be. The sets weren't massive epic set pieces, but at the very least, they managed to evoke the spirit of the environments from the game. Not too many that were actual full-on glaring emulations, I would say, of too many of the stages. But again, it's the fact that it looked like it could have been from a Mortal Kombat stage. It's the same kind of credit that I really grudgingly had to give Anderson for the first and second Resident Evil movies. Is okay, for everything you fucked up, this at least feels like the world of Resident Evil. This feels like the mansion in the Arklay Mountains outside Raccoon City. This feels like Raccoon City after being devastated by the zombie apocalypse. So at the very least, despite you cramming your hot ass wife down our gullets until we're choking on her freaking pubic hair, you know, props to you for that. I give you that much. God only knows where the hell he went wrong.
So I got a question for you.
But, yeah, fire away.
Worst use of wife, Tim Burton or Paul Anderson?
Oh, Jesus, it's neck and neck.
See, I don't know. I'm going to tell you that it's Tim Burton.
I don't know. I almost, if we're talking about worst use, I almost got to give the nod to Tim for one reason, and that's because Helena Bonham Carter is a vastly more gifted performer than she has ever had the chance to exhibit in a Tim Burton movie. I can't really say, as much as I resent her presence in the Resident Evil movies and in Monster Hunter, I can't really say that it was a bad use of Mila Jovovich, because she goes up there and does pretty much what she does best.
So I 100% agree with you, but for different reasons. Paul W.S. Anderson always accentuates Mila Jovovich. Mila Jovovich looks better than she might actually be. She always looks hot. She always looks sexier. She always looks tougher. She always looks more like a badass in stuff she does with her husband. Her husband is like her Paul Heyman. He like highlights all the good things about her.
I will give Mila credit for this much. What I've always heard is that she did a lot of her own fight scenes and stunt work.
Good.
For the movies. And some of those stunts were pretty brutal. So if that's true, you know, props to her. She's a trooper for that much.
Yep. As opposed to Tim Burton, who constantly makes his wife look like a crack whore. Like everything he does, like, why are you dirtying this gorgeous woman up? And I've said this a few times about various shows, but it really hit me on the last season of The Crown. When she was playing Princess Margaret, and I'm like, holy Christ, Helena Bonham Carter,
gorgeous,
is amazing looking. She's just an absolute beauty, just an elegant woman. What have you done to this poor woman, Tim Burton? You monster. Not sure which is worse, Tim Burton, Martin Scorsese, or George Lucas. I will go back to my seat now. You may finish your recitation.
But I will give you this. While Lambert doesn't exactly exude the majesty of an all-powerful, omnipresent elder god, he at least has fun and really kind of maximizes his moments on screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little disappointing to not see Raiden in full-on destructive badass mode, but then again, it's still a damn sight better than James Remar in Annihilation. So, you know, choose which hill you want to die on carefully, I suppose.
Yep.
Yeah. It ends pretty satisfactorily. Again, in keeping with the lore, with Liu Kang winning the tournament. And yeah, and we're off to sequel land, and it's deeply unfortunate that we didn't get a better sequel than we did, because this was the one that really should have set the model for video game movies to follow. And I mean, to kind of transition out of this and into maybe talking about the new movie, you know, I read the plot synopsis and I just kind of noped right out. Because the fact is, it takes so many contrivances and liberties with the lore. And you know, I get it. There's room for flexibility. You know, true enough. But it's just, and I begrudge nobody who enjoys it. You know, by all means, like what you like. But at the same time, the look of it aside, it's definitely not what I want from a Mortal Kombat movie. Again, and this is just bringing it full circle, when it comes to movies based on games, it doesn't have to be note for note, line for line. You know, bend, flex a little bit, but still recognize that we're not necessarily interested in your fresh fanfic take on things. We just want to see the thing that we like in a different way. Not different as in a different point of view on the story or the characters necessarily, but just we want to see just how potentially awesome it could be with this shit being performed for us by real life flesh and blood human beings. That's it. It's why, frankly, I'm not optimistic about Uncharted. I'm somewhat optimistic about The Last of Us, just because I know who is helming that and I have great faith in them. But fuck's sake, Hollywood, please, I'm begging you, don't ever get near Mass Effect. Don't do that to me.
All I can say is, if the Mario movie isn't everything my son wants it to be, Hollywood is going to burn. my son will be the one taking a torch to it.
Wait, are they making another one?
Yeah, they are. 2022 or 2023, yeah.
You're kidding.
Nope. I'm sure, and I'm sure it's going to be like leaning into the seriousness. Mario is going to be some sort of badass, you know. I don't know what take they're going with, but I suspect it's not going to be, you know, let's lean into Captain Lou Albano and the old Saturday morning Mario Brothers show.
Okay, Nintendo. I want to make sure that I understand this here, and that this isn't all some COVID shot induced fever dream. We know that you've heard the people who have been clamoring for years for a Legend of Zelda series.
That's coming. That's coming to Netflix, isn't it?
Oh, Mark, that's an over 10 years old April Fool's joke.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. unless something has changed that I've been hitherto unaware of, because, you know, I wouldn't turn my nose up at a good adaptation of Metroid, just saying. And your idea for how you want to reapproach this idea of Hollywood making your games into movies is you want to go back and let someone take a stab at Super Mario Brothers again.
Yes, Nintendo, because Mario sells Nintendos.
Nintendo, and there's a lot of evidence preceding this that should have really convinced me before now. There's no convincing me that you don't hate your fans. with the fire of a million suns of a million multiverses. I don't know why you hate us, but clearly you hate us.
Okay. If I asked you, I mean, you kind of just said some, but for the sake of argument, if you had to give Hollywood a list of your top five video games that have not already been made into a movie or a television show, what's out there? If you could produce any five video game movies that hasn't already been done, what would you go with?
Now, and we're assuming that...
And let me just say, they're already doing Tetris, because I know that would have been number one.
So I'm assuming that this is with the codicil that assuming Hollywood gets it right.
Well, yeah, you're producing.
Correct. Okay.
You have a $200 million budget.
Metal Gear Solid. Red Dead Redemption. It's I know you could say there's a that yeah we've already had so many westerns, but it's God, it's
hey,
such an amazing
story.
For a few
dollars more, why can't we have more westerns?
Let's see. Give me a really well done version of Assassin's Creed 2. Not that bullshit Assassin's Creed movie that you let Michael Fassbender pawn off in theaters that entirely missed the fucking point. No, give me a good version of Assassin's Creed 2. Let's see, so that's Metal Gear Solid, Red Dead Redemption, Assassin's Creed 2. What else would be really good?
Didn't you and I both agree that they should have adapted the Arkham Asylum games into a trilogy?
See, now you got me. Okay, you know what? I take Assassin's Creed 2 back. Yes. Give us a good adaptation of the four Arkham games. You can do it animated or a series. I don't know that a feature film version would work for any game except for Arkham Asylum in full, but give me a full length animated series of those. Ooh, yes, y'all. BioShock, especially if you can find a way to revive the version that was going to be made by Gore Verbinski. And last but not least, if you could ever get everyone on the same page to really get it right, yes, you may do a Mass Effect movie. But you better be damn fucking careful, and you had better really start figuring out your end game before you get to the ending of the third game.
Nope.
Because otherwise,
produce. Go ahead. You're producing. You've been given your budget by the studio. The studio is MGM. Okay, they're fairly hands off. They're not a total embarrassment. I'm not going to go with in my fictional universe I've created where you're a movie producer. You're not having to work with Warner Brothers or Disney. So let's say it's MGM, okay? And they're saying, Sean, besides James Bond, we got Bupkis, and we are trying to keep the studio alive. We want to make a Mass Effect movie. You produce. So pick your director.
Oh, God. Someone to direct a Mass Effect movie. Oh, that's a tough one. See, my short list would be J.J. Abrams would have to be on there. That's going to piss so many people off, but, you know, he's got
to. I don't even know what Mass Effect is, and I'm already angry. J.J. Abrams?
It's an epic space opera in three parts.
Okay.
Abrams has got to at least be in the conversation, I think. God, Peter Jackson could do it so much justice because he's such a lore hound.
Now you're on my wavelength. I want to see Peter Jackson do space. What about Christopher Nolan?
Oh boy. Maybe he could maybe get it right. I'd be a little concerned that he'd maybe make it a little too stylized.
It would be a visual masterpiece. I mean, there's one thing that Nolan does well, and I think
that
it would look amazing.
About the only guy that I think visually could make that look as good as Nolan would be Del Toro, because you have so many alien races, and you need somebody who can make the Reapers look absolutely pants shittingly, living rent free in your nightmares for the rest of your life, terrifying.
Okay. Short list of lead actors. Who's your star?
Who's going
on the poster?
If we're going with male Shepherd, I would say Tom Hardy or Chris Evans.
Okay, well, if you get Tom Hardy, you get Christopher Nolan.
If we're going with Femme Shep, and we're assuming the default model with the short red hair, you know, were she not such a raging fucking bitch in so many regards, I'd almost say Scarlett Johansson.
Is she? I swear to God, I thought the end of the sentence was going to be Gina Carano.
But, fuck. Hang on a sec. What was that, honey? Oh, God, I'm blanking on her name. Quick, Sansa from Game of Thrones. What was her name?
I'll look it up, and I'll just shout it over whatever you say next. Who's your villain?
Elizabeth Olsen could be great, too. Oh, you know what? Never mind. Femme Shep is Elizabeth Olsen. Full stop.
Okay. The actress's name is Sophie Turner, by the way.
Sophie Turner. Okay, yeah, she wouldn't be a bad choice. If we're talking about... Okay, well, the two main villains are, if you got to cast the elusive man... God, just get Martin Sheen. He was the voice in the game, and you're not going to do any better. Okay. Nobody is going to do better than him in that role. And if you're talking about... Sovereign, the voice of the Reapers. God, if he were alive, Christopher Lee could have been perfect. He would have been so utterly terrifying. Can't be Keith David, because you need him to play Admiral Anderson, as he did in the game. God damn, that's a tough one. That is a really tough... I need booming, heartless... Wait. Heartless. Wait a sec. Billy Zane.
All right, last question. Mm-hmm. Who do you get to score it? Do you get Danny Elfman, XL Junkie? Who do you get?
Oh my God, who could score this?
Or do you go with, like, modern pop music?
I would say, well, you're going to need somebody to kind of lend a little bit of electronica to it. Okay. I would say,
um, What's his that used to be in the band that just broke up, the techno band that you like?
Daft Punk?
Yeah.
If you could get... I would say get Daft Punk and see if you can get them to score it alongside either Hans Zimmer or DeWaldi, the guy who did the score for Lord of the Rings, Pacific Rim, and Iron Man.
Howard Shore?
No, it's not Howard Shore. Ramin Djawadi. Yes, that's it. Yes, get Daft Punk to do the score alongside Ramin Djawadi.
Well, if you would like to hear more from Daft Punk or Howard Shore or Ramin Djawadi or any of these people that Danny Elfman, if you would like to hear any of these soundtrack scores, because who doesn't like a good soundtrack score? I used to know in the Braveheart one, I used to like soundtrack scores so much. The Braveheart score is fantastic, by the way. It's a movie we should talk about someday. You should click our link in the description for Amazon Music and get yourself a free 30 days of Amazon Music, and you can stream. Maybe you don't like soundtrack scores, but you maybe you want to stream some Scooter, or you want to stream some KMFDM, you want to stream some Utah Saints after you've just been watching that Mortal Kombat soundtrack and you're like, dance party, gotta play the Utah Saints, gotta get some Scooter going. And you can find all that on amazonmusic.com/W2M Network. That's getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network. Be My Sister Salvation joint Jezebel is coming from my creation. Be My. Anyway, you can find a better version of the person who actually sang Juke Joint Jezebel, KMFDM, on AmazonMusic.com. Isn't that wonderful? All right. I think we're done here. You fan-casted your Mass Effect movie, and as I say, once it's set on my podcast, the unpaid intern who takes all of our ideas usually runs with it and makes it reality. Ruins it, typically, but at least it's out there now. In the world for Hollywood to hear. So that's it. I think we've covered it. I think Sean's defense of it, you know, is as good as you're going to get. You know, it hits the pitches. It's not perfect, but it hits the pitches it's supposed to hit for what it's supposed to be in the time that it was made in. In a lot of ways, it's better than the new one. But I think the last thing I want to say on this, I'll give Sean the actual last word, and then we'll do plugs and get out of here. I think a third crack at this needs to be tried. I don't think they figured out the equation for how to produce a best Mortal Kombat movie. I think the players need to go on some sort of quest that ends in a tournament, or there needs to be some sort of personal chase. I liked the natural animosity of Scorpion and Sub-Zero. I wish more had been made of that instead of how they did it.
Mark, I've got your answer to that.
Okay, go ahead.
The rebooted trilogy has enough lore and character development and story and newly introduced characters to fill out at least 3, if not 4, movies. At least, including a whole lot more development.
Okay.
For Scorpion and both Sub-Zeros.
So we'll get, you know, a screenwriter, you know, a young screenwriter who will just do as they're told, and they'll adapt the video game, and we'll get Brett Ratner to direct it, because he'll direct anything, and we'll just make him wear an ankle bracelet.
Fucking Ratner.
He'll make the movie you want him to make. He has no artistic vision.
Fuck your couch. I should have never given you X-Men.
Ratner will walk up to you and say, "What do you have, sir?" And you'll say, "I'll have a Mortal Kombat picture." And he was like, "Would you like fries with that?" And you'll say, "Yes." And he'll say, "Okay." And he will give you a Mortal Kombat with fries. Because that's Brett Ratner. All right. Anything else before we go?
I got nothing. By all means, you know, take a second, see it, and then marvel at what this man did to Resident Evil.
All right. So next week is like Sean Comer week. We just dedicated a whole week to him.
It's not even my birthday.
So Sean's going to make his appearance on Source Material Monday night. We're doing the first two books of the Scott Pilgrim collection. They are collected as part of the Color Collection Volume 1, but it's Scott Pilgrim versus the World and Scott Pilgrim, whatever the very first book is called. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But it's the first two books of the Scott Pilgrim collection. On Tuesday, Sean will be on the Metal Hammer of Doom with Sean Garmer and Jesse Starcher, and we will be looking at the Animataguchi album Scott Pilgrim versus the World, the video game soundtrack. Oh boy, that's going to be exciting. We're giving Sean Wednesday off so that he can be with his family and play video games and work and not have to talk to me. So instead, aww, you'll hear Jess, you'll hear Alexis Haina and I review the new Looney Tunes One Charlie. And then in the evening times, instead of doing the Metal Hammer of Doom, myself and Jesse Starcher will review Pennyworth Season 2. But have no fear, Monfrier. We are re-releasing a Metal Hammer of Doom in time for Cinco de Mayo. It's Brujeria. Viva Presidente Trump. And Pacho Atzlin. It's a show we did a couple years back. We're re-airing it just in time to celebrate Cinco de Mayo. How about that? I got a triple header for you on May 6th. We'll start off the day with me and Chris Bailey reviewing AEW Blood and Guts. Then Alexis Haina and I are going to review The Mitchells vs. the Machines, which debuts on Netflix tomorrow as of this recording. And then Sean is back in the main event of the week. The thing that he has been... Folks, I make a lot of pitches to a lot of people. I work with a lot of people in the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network, and I throw things out there, and the silence is deafening. Just cacophonous silence. You could hear the crickets from miles on end. But I happened to mention offhandedly Scott Pilgrim, and I was stampeded! Run over! Nerds! From everywhere! Some I didn't even know! Came storming into the room, going, Scott Pilgrim? And I beat them off with a stick! And I said, Sean got here first. Apparently, it's the most important movie to him ever in the history of celluloid film.
It's right up there. Yeah. At some point, some chode said, there's no such thing as a perfect movie. And Edgar Wright said, hold my fucking beer.
So I have the disreputable pleasure of having to prosecute this thing. Well, Sean will reach back into the 2013 and yell wrong, 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 wrong at me for an hour and a half as he tells me and sings the praises of Scott Pilgrim versus the World as it returns to theaters this weekend. And so we are celebrating that by doing an on trial for Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I promised I would never resurrect the wrong song, and I'm a man of my word.
I tease. I kid. But the line to do that show of people who wanted to be on it formed to the left, and I was like, it's a fucking two-man show. Calm your tits. Jesus. Doesn't anyone want to do Shadow and Bone? Damn, there's those damn crickets again.
What network is Shadow and Bone on?
Netflix.
You need somebody to do it?
You'd be the only one that would volunteer.
When do you want to do it?
I killed it because no one wanted to do it, so let you and me talk when the show's over. Friday the 7th is our re-airing of Days of Future Past, and then I don't know if I told you about this. I thought I might have offline, just like halfway mentioned it, but on a rare occasion I was able to get my wife on a handful of podcasts, and this was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So this is me, you, and her discussing the Twilight Saga.
Oh, yes, I remember this one.
Yeah, apparently for the entire length and breadth of the podcast, after she said her name, she also said he broke the bed. Which apparently cracked Jesse up, from what he tells me. So, get ready on May 8th to download a show where you could feel my wife gushing about Robert Pattinson breaking a bed on Kristen Stewart's ass. Like all the good boys do. Also, we're reviewing Demon Slayer, the movie, this Sunday, May 2nd. So I forgot to mention that. All right, that's it. That's all my plugs. Sean, do your thing, and I will hit the music, baby doll.
Short and sweet. If you want to find out when I'm going to be streaming on Twitch, usually either story-based games, Apex Legends, Overwatch, or various NetherRealm Studios fighters such as Mortal Kombat and Injustice and Injustice 2, follow me on Twitter at Comer Codex.
All right, folks, thank you for joining us here on Trial. Court is dismissed. Be well, be safe, and behave.